The most basic one is, because a lot of times people will ask, you know, what can I help my student in terms of managing the anxiety better or feeling less anxious? And a lot of times they're looking at something to do in that moment. And there certainly are important things to do right before we start playing or right as we're playing during a performance. But a lot of it, to be honest, comes in the practice room well beforehand.
Well, what's up, teachers of the world? It's Tim Topham here from the Topcast, and you're listening to episode number 224. That felt a bit weird saying what's up, guys, but I hear people do it on podcasts all the time. What do you think? Should I keep doing that as a greeting? Or do you find it annoying a little bit like I do? Let us know over in the Top Music Teaching Facebook group. It'd be kind of fun to know. Anyway, today I'm delighted to share with you another rebroadcast from our archive favourites. And this one is with the fabulous Noah Kagayama. Now, if you haven't found out about his blog over at The Bulletproof Musician, then you are missing out. If you've got students that perform regularly and you want to get the best out of them in any way, any area of performance, then Noah is the absolute guru on this topic. He has an incredible resume of things that he's done, roles that he holds, and I had a fantastic time right at the start of the pandemic last year when he asked me to join him on a webinar with one of his great friends for all the teachers over in New York. And it was just great to reconnect with him. He is such a wealth of knowledge and such a down-to-earth guy. So I really hope you enjoy today's episode, which, as I mentioned at the end of last episode 223, the reason why this is really important is because dealing with those nerves around performance and taking exams and going for auditions and things like that is something that students can actually work on all the time, and not just in the, you know, freak out week leading up to when they have to perform suddenly. And I think this conversation will really open your eyes to how that process can unfold during the year, why it's important, and most importantly, some steps that you can take to help your students. So let's head over to that conversation. Oh, one other thing too, just in case you haven't found out about it, the podcast producer role is now open. So we are looking for a producer for the show to take on the role of organizing this incredible podcast now in its sixth year and well over 220 episodes. It's a very exciting time, and we hope we can find the right person to come and join us. So if that's of interest to you, head to topmusic.co/producer. By the way, have you checked out the Top Music Marketplace recently? We're continually adding new products. We've got new sellers joining us on a weekly basis, and we are trying to always make it the best place for you to go when you need a resource for your studio. So if you haven't gone and checked it out yet, then please do so. You can head over to topmusicmarketplace.com and do some browsing. Use the search box at the top or go via our collections, which are linked in the top menu or on the front page. Okay, let's head to our interview with Noah Kagayama. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Tim Topham TV episode 21. Thank you so much for listening, as always. I'm really excited about this episode in particular because it's one that's very close to my heart, and it's one that I've wanted to do all year, actually, and I had to find the right person to help me with this one. It's all about performance anxiety. And I've titled it Helping Students Cope. And in today's episode, I'm interviewing Dr. Noah Kagayama, who is the Bulletproof Musician. Many of you will know his blog online. It's a fantastic resource for students and teachers alike. And I came across his work when I was doing my diploma a few years back. And his advice and the advice of others was just absolutely indispensable when it came to helping me cope with my own performance anxiety. And the reason I think this is so important is because as teachers, we often just throw our students into doing recitals without a whole lot of thought or support for their own performance anxiety issues. And for some students, it's quite an ordeal, really. Certainly for younger students, it's often very easy for a 7 or 8 year old to get up and play something. They you know, make it look like it's the easiest thing ever. But as students get older and a bit more self-conscious, particularly through teenage years and certainly as adults, it becomes a real issue. And I know that a lot of teachers, myself included, really struggle with how to give students guidance with coping with performance anxiety. So that's what this episode's all about. And I know you're going to get a lot out of it. And I know most of you will have students who you ask to perform because it's such an important part of what we do. So let me tell you a little bit about
Dr. Noah Kageyama, who is, as I said, the bulletproof musician. He actually is a violin student. He learned from the age of 2. He's now a doctor of psychology, and he has a master's of performance from Juilliard. And he says he spent most of his life studying and training to become a concert violinist. And this is him talking. One day, however, I realized that I was actually much more intrigued by the study of peak performance and what it took to become a great performer than in becoming a great performer myself. So after completing my master's at the Juilliard School, I went to Indiana University for a master's and doctorate in counseling psychology with a specialization in sport and performance psychology. And a lot of what he's learned and some of the techniques that he uses come from another person who I've blogged about before, who's Dr. Don Green, who you can research as well. And they share similar ideas about performance anxiety. And a lot of it comes from sport theory. So it's really interesting how the two combine. Noah goes on to say, despite my successes in his performing, I struggled with inconsistency and felt that my playing often fell short of what I knew I was capable of. It was frustrating to play so well in rehearsals and then sound like a different person on stage. Like many musicians, I just assumed that I needed to practice more. I figured that nerves would fade away at some point. Neither was true. Sometimes they'd sound great, sometimes just mediocre, and I couldn't find out how to control it. And, you know, put your hand up if you felt like that before. I certainly have. So he's on the faculty of the Juilliard School in New York and the New World Symphony in Miami, where he helps talented musicians prepare for orchestral job auditions. He conducts workshops and webinars on performance enhancement and overcoming anxiety all over the United States. And he has a fantastic blog. Have a listen to a couple. I just went through his archives and had found 3 articles. I love how he writes. It's always intriguing. Here's a few of them. The titles of his blog posts: Your Brain Isn't Wired for Consistency, But That's Not as Depressing as It Sounds. Well, how about this? A Simple Technique to Prevent Choking Under Pressure, which sounds like it couldn't possibly work. Or another post is Why Practicing While Distracted is Actually Very Important. Sometimes. If you like evidence-based research on psychology and practice, then this episode is 100% for you. His blog is really, really popular. He speaks really well, and he gives away so many great ideas. So here is my interview with the Bulletproof Musician, helping you understand how you can help your students overcome and deal with performance anxiety.
Hey, Noah, welcome to the show. So great to have you with me.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
It's been quite a while that I've wanted to have you on the show, because I have been a massive fan of your blog for quite some time. And I know a lot of my readers have been in the same kind of position. So I'm really fascinated to know the main kind of things that you spend your time doing at the moment. Can you just give us a little bit of an outline of what your kind of normal day looks like, if you have a normal day?
Well, I mean, for me, the week kind of revolves around the Sunday blog posts, because I know that there's a specific deadline. And so every day there's a bit of reading, and I scan the internet to see what new studies are out there, what people are talking about, and I try to do a little bit of writing as well. And then I have teaching days where I teach classes at school, and then also clients on a day basis. So it's, you know, it's usually a matter of trying to figure out where to schedule those main 4 or 5 activities in the course of a day. So it's a little bit different every day, but also a little bit the same.
Yeah. So it's a bit, you spend some time at Juilliard still. Do you still teach there?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm actually teaching in 3 very different divisions, which is kind of interesting because it's the same material, but a different sort of population. I mean, so there's the regular college division, and then there's pre-college. So younger students, younger musicians, and then an evening division, which is folks from the community who may be professional musicians, but also may be very serious amateur musicians.
Okay. And is that, are you teaching piano performance, or are you working on the performance anxiety and, you know, performance skills side?
Yeah, it's all just the performance anxiety, the performance skills and the mindset part of it. Yeah.
Fantastic. Well, look, that's what we're here to talk about today. And look, I'm going to guess, you know, 99% maybe of teachers, you know, get their students to perform pretty regularly, but mm-hmm. I'd be really surprised if any more than, I don't know, what do you reckon, 5-10% of teachers actually teach and give students coping strategies for this horrible, often, anxiety that we put them through. You know, some kids, it's very easy, but I know personally what it's like. It is terrifying getting up on stage, and I think as teachers, we often forget that. So why do you think it is not a topic that we talk about very much with our students?
Well, you know, I think it's a couple things. One hour of instruction a week is not a lot of time to teach the kinds of things that we want to share with our students. And there's so much they have to learn, you know, from just the mechanics of playing the instrument to, you know, learning music and understanding how to look at scores and interpretation and musicality. I mean, all these different elements that we wish we could have more time to share with them and teach them and help them along with. You know, it doesn't leave a lot of time for dealing with performances, which for a lot of students may not happen all that often. You know, as they get older, it happens more frequently. But at younger ages, you know, it's maybe once a year, at most maybe once a quarter, but not so often. So, you know, so there's not that urgency on a week-to-week basis to really address this particular issue. And also, at least back in the day, this wasn't something that the teachers were trained in. You know, I don't think most people feel particularly comfortable with doing this sort of thing. So, I mean, all those things together, it to me, it makes a lot of sense why it wouldn't be a major focus of weekly instruction.
Yeah. And even, you know, a lot of us have 30-minute lessons, of course, when we're teaching younger kids, so it's even harder. Do you think it should be given greater priority? And if so, at what age or at what level?
I mean, I think for me, there are a number of reasons why I think, and I'm a little bit biased, obviously, but I think there are a number of reasons why it should be more of a priority. I mean, one, you know, if the student's going on to become a professional musician, whether it's performing or whether it's teaching, it's a helpful skill to have and a helpful understanding in terms of how to prepare for these performances and do our best at these performances, which, you know, the better we do can lead to other doors opening and other possibilities. And so there's that group of folks. But then there's also the group of students who may know fairly early on that they're not going to go the professional route, but still would like to be able to perform more effectively and be able to then transfer these skills. Because I think a lot of what students get from musical training isn't just how to become a professional musician, but, you know, how to focus on improving skills on a week-to-week basis, how to concentrate and focus more effectively, you know, how to think in very different abstract sort of ways. I mean, there's also lots of research coming out about how involvement and engagement in the arts helps with lots of other endeavors in the future. So if this could be yet another skill set that they take from them, from their lessons and their musical experience, you know, for performing more effective job interviews or public speeches or presentations to the board of directors or brain surgery, whatever it may be, being able to perform your best under pressure, I think, is a helpful skill to develop from an early age. And as far as why early, you know, I think there are lots of ways of integrating this sort of preparation and mental training in ways that little kids are quite receptive to and don't even realize what they're doing and the value of it.
Mm.
Easier to get people when they're younger.
That's true. I imagine some of them might look blankly at you if you tried to give them some tactics about focusing or you know, helping with anxiety when they're eight, because they all seem totally fearless. Or most students uh-huh. are at that age. They just kind of get up, they'll perform, bow. It's like easiest thing they've done. But it obviously, yeah. it tends to get harder as we grow up and we become, I assume, more self-conscious or more worried about people's opinions of us. Am I kind of on the track? Is that why this is a bigger thing for teenagers and adults?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the longer we're involved in it, the stakes seem to get a little bit higher. There's pressure from, you know, teachers or parents or peers or the situation and competitions and higher stakes performances and more people. And yes, as we get older, we just generally get a little bit more self-conscious and self-aware and aware of consequences. But even at an early age, you know, I remember my mom when I was maybe even four, you know, when she made me lie down for a nap on days of a performance, would play a recording and just tell me to imagine that was me playing. Let's imagine myself, just close my eyes, imagine myself on stage where I was going to be playing and hearing that recording coming out of my instrument. And I thought, you know, this is kind of a silly thing my mom was making me do. And I still remember, like, kind of mentally resisting doing this. But, I mean, that was a visualization. I was doing it from the time I was little and tiny and probably wasn't really feeling any nerves, but it was, and she never talked about nerves or anxiety or worrying or things like that, but it was just part of what I did. And I didn't realize until many years later what was happening or what I was actually involved in.
Mm. And look, I'd love to come back to that visualization as a technique. But before that, just I was interested to read in your bio that Don Green had been one of your influences. And he's someone who I heard speak in Melbourne probably 3 or 4 years ago. And I read his one of his books too. And it was a great help to me. I gather that perhaps your mother had given you some tips, but was it only after sort of some of Don's techniques you were able to use that you found yourself feeling more confident also in your performing? So your teachers perhaps didn't give you that training either. Would that be right?
Yeah. I mean, my teachers gave me the best possible musical training I could have gotten, you know, instrumental and musical training I could have gotten. I really couldn't have asked for anything more. But how to perform your best under pressure wasn't an area of expertise. I mean, they'd figured it out for themselves because they were obviously able to get on stage and perform at the highest level, but wasn't systematically. And so when I took Don Green's class at Juilliard, I mean, it all kind of sounds obvious in hindsight and maybe seems that way when you talk about it with other folks, but that there were a concrete set of mental skills that if you develop those and work on them, there were also actually specific drills and exercises and ways to hone, develop, and strengthen these skills that when you do that, you actually consistently perform better under pressure was sort of a revelation to me. It's like, I mean, it seems so obvious, like, yeah, you work on the mental game just like athletes do, but I'd never really seen what that looks like in concrete terms for a musician. And so that was what really opened my eyes to, and also not just how interesting it was, but to feel it and see it make a difference in the end result on stage was such a cool thing. It's like, wow, I work on this. I can do something about it. Yeah. This is pretty awesome.
Yeah. And you mentioned just before athletes, and I know a lot of your work and a lot of your blog articles are related to the psychology of sports. They relate, the psychology of sports to the psychology of music performance. Mm-hmm. So in your opinion, what are the similarities between sport and music performance that makes the connection, that connection so relevant?
Well, it's fortunate that we can use a lot of what athletes and sports psychologists have found for musicians, because otherwise there just isn't as much literature out there just on musicians. I mean, at the end of the day, and I forget who said this, but someone once said that performance is performance is performance. So I mean, I meant that, you know, with brain surgery, whether it's a surgeon performing a serious procedure or having to give a high stakes speech or performing in front of, you know, 1,000 people at Carnegie Hall or shooting a free throw in an important basketball game. It comes down to our ability to execute a skill that we've rehearsed and practiced ahead of time at the highest possible level, given only one opportunity to do so. And that part of all of those is the same. What we have to do physically, what we have to do mentally, what we have to do emotionally to optimize our chances of actually performing in a way that's reflective of how we're capable. Those three things I think are what ties it all together. You know, optimal emotional states, optimal mental states, and optimal physical states.
I love the idea of the fact that we as teachers of one style of performance can give our students skills that they'll be able to use for the rest of their lives in, as you say, public speaking or job interviews and things like that. I think that as a listener, I imagine some teachers would be thinking, yeah, this is something I probably, you know, should not only for my students and their piano performance, but I should be thinking about as a greater skill set, just as we teach self-discipline perhaps in practice techniques or focus on concentration in being able to learn a particularly difficult part of a score. So I really like that more broadened, you've kind of broadened already my view of this as a topic, which is great. So let's zoom in. I want to really zoom in on some concrete ideas that teachers could start using next week with their students in lessons. So we know it's kind of coming up to Christmas and end of year recital season. I recently had some students, a student perform at one of our end of year big masses at the school I teach at, and that was pretty high stakes. That was on pipe organ too, and he was playing Toccata and Fugue in D minor, which is one of the trickiest pieces of all. And that was high pressure game. So I would love to hear some of your views. You know, what can we do step by step? What are some really key things we can do with our students to help them?
The most basic one is, because a lot of times people ask, you know, what can I help my student with in terms of managing the anxiety better or feeling less anxious. And a lot of times they're looking at something to do in that moment. And there certainly are important things to do right before we start playing or right as we're playing during a performance. But a lot of it, to be honest, comes in the practice room well beforehand. So practicing in a particular kind of way. I mean, because one of the things that I think as teachers we're trying to do is try to get our students to listen to themselves better, right? More critically, more quickly, and be able to actually catch things so they don't keep playing it the wrong way time after time after time and they show up at the lesson having really reinforced the incorrect way of playing something. And so that's something that takes some time to develop, and they get really good at it. But the problem is that's an essential and excellent mindset for the practice room to develop skills and to make sure that we're not making mistakes. But it's a horrible, ineffective one for on stage, right? Because when we're on stage, if we start listening to self-monitoring ears, where we're trying to look for and seek out and pay attention to and monitor and criticize and analyze errors and mistakes and imperfections as they're happening, it kind of into this downward spiral of trying not to screw anything else up. And so part of it in the practice room ahead of time is how do we turn on and off that analytical mindset so that when we get on stage, we can shut it off and replace it with something else, which we can talk about in a moment. But so that's where mock performances or just run-throughs, even in lessons, can be really helpful, where it's not just, okay, can you get through the piece, but can you not only get through the piece, but practice an optimal performance mindset? So they can even rate themselves on a scale of 1 to 10, you know, 10 being in two different areas, 10 being, you know, awesome performance, just musically, technically, everything, just the actual playing part. And then the other factor that they can rate themselves on is the mental side of things. You know, how focused were they? Like, how distracted were they? You know, if 10 would be, you know, really awesome performance focus. I wasn't paying attention to mistakes. I was really in the moment. I wasn't thinking ahead to difficult things, or I wasn't thinking about what I'm going to eat for dinner tonight. I was really zoned in. And if they can get consistently high scores in both areas, then, you know, we know that they're on track to have a pretty good performance. It's so not just having... Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. No, I was just going to say, it's the same kind of thing for, I think, anyway, correct me if I'm wrong, my approach with students to sight reading, they have to turn off the analytical. Yeah. They almost have to not listen.
Absolutely.
And just play, you know, it's so difficult. So I wonder if you've, and perhaps you're going to go into a couple of tips about how to actually get students into that optimal performance mindset and to ignore their mistakes.
So, I mean, part of it could just be seeing how long you can play without having any thoughts about mistakes that you've made. And then having students play, and then once they register a thought that's now analytical in nature or judgmental in nature, have them stop playing. So they may only be able to get like one or two notes in, or maybe they can get further. Yeah. But to make them aware of how often that sort of thing is happening is one kind of fun exercise for that kind of performance practice. But they did, there's an individual at Johns Hopkins, and who's also on the faculty of Peabody in Baltimore, who is interested in jazz, but was a medical researcher, and he did this study where they put jazz pianists in an MRI machine. They created a little keyboard that they could play inside the MRI machine and had them play over the same background track twice. You know, once they performed this pre-composed melody that they had to memorize and learn ahead of time and play over top of this background track. And then they had them, you know, just ignore that pre-composed thing altogether and just freely improvise over the background track. And what they found was that the brain activation pattern in those two scenarios was the reciprocal of one another. I mean, in the freely improvised version, you know, the part of the brain responsible for monitoring, analyzing, and critiquing had to shut off, right? Just like you're saying, I mean, you can't, John Cage once said you can't, or he encouraged people not to try to analyze and create at the same time because they're two different processes. And I think that study kind of illustrates that there's probably a good deal of truth to that. So, I mean, the improv angle is kind of interesting. So there's other studies about improv and how that can change not just our experience of performing, but the listener's experience of performing. And I won't go into the details of the study necessarily, but one approach that's also interesting for teachers to have students experiment with is to approach something that they've played and know very well, but when they perform it, to try to take this mindset of improvisation. So basically, you ask them to play it, but to focus on offering subtle new nuances to their performance. So this might be slightly different nuances in terms of dynamics or tone color or, you know, even pacing to degree. And if they get overwhelmed by the choices, just pick one. Say, all right, you know what? You can offer subtle new nuances just in terms of dynamics or just in terms of color, just in terms of, you know, forward and backward movement. And what that'll often do, and you can experiment with yourself, kind of see how it feels when you play it one time where your focus is on trying to, you know, play it the best you can, just like it's a big competition, you don't want to screw anything up. And then the other time where you're focused on obviously trying to play as well as you can, but while offering subtle nuances. And just kind of see what the mental experience of it is, and then tape yourself both times and see which one even sounds more compelling and interesting to you. But it does tend to change our focus on what we want and what we're trying to create, as opposed to what just happened and what are we afraid of.
Mm. I like that as a pretty straightforward thing that we could use in a lesson. So you're saying, you know, take a student that's kind of performance ready with a piece, and instead of just listening to them play through it, you ask them to add a nuance to the performance consciously, add something that's different. And you're saying that that focus on the new dynamics or articulation or whatever it is, or speed, will help them stop analyzing and let them kind of be a bit more freer. Is that right?
Yeah. For some folks, it actually seems to paralyze them, because they get into this place in their head where it's like, okay, I could do this or I could do that. Which one should I do? Which one is right? Which one's wrong? And like, they just kind of get themselves stuck. Yeah. And so you can ask them what the experience was like, and you can probably even tell if you have a student that's taking that approach to it. But the idea is to not choose, but literally to do these micro improvisations in the moment. Just kind of go with whatever happens in this narrow range of possibilities that exists, without changing the notes or the rhythms completely. And you can tell them to make the nuances so subtle that they probably can't even tell.
Right.
Not they as the student, but the teacher. You know, like, I'm not going to be able to hear these things, maybe, but you definitely can tell that you're doing these things ever so slightly differently.
Now, you've used the two words I want to zoom in on a little bit more. One is focus, and the other zoned in. Can you tell us, because I think these two are obviously crucial, that element of just being completely in the moment and being able to, well, this is how I see it anyway, kind of ignore almost, even though you're playing to an audience, kind of ignore them and not let them, and not let coughs and doors slamming and stuff affect you. So can you give us some tips on how we can help our students focus, either as they're practicing or before the performance or during it?
So before is an important factor, because a lot of times I think we're a little bit frazzled when we walk out on stage, and so we don't have much of a game plan as far as what should I think about right before I start playing. I mean, even with like instrumentalists, sometimes you see them forget the tune, or, you know, they just, I remember one time my mom was mortified, but, you know, I turned around to take an A from the piano, and then I forgot to turn back around, so I played the whole concert with my back to the audience because I was still facing the piano from getting my A. And so, you know, once we get on, I had a friend who once, you know, is a terrific chamber musician, and so is playing chamber music concerts, you know, all the time, but hasn't soloed with orchestra for a while. And so, you know, this particular situation, just walked out and I shook the conductor's hand, concertmaster's hand, and, plump right piano bench. And, got ready to start playing, forgetting entirely to bow to the audience. So, you know, we get a little bit crazy in our heads sometimes before we play, and so it's helpful before we start actually making sound come out of the piano to have some sort of a pre-performance routine or a sequence that we go through, just to make sure that, you know, mentally and physically we're in a better place. And so that could be from just scanning body tension real quick to make sure that we're not, you know, our shoulders are not up by our ears and we're like, you know, freezing up. But maybe more even having a particular kind of focus. And, you know, they did an interesting research study with golfers at Arizona State, where they wanted to find out what were they thinking about, you know, the successful ones. What were they thinking about right before executing a successful putt? And it really just came down to two things. One, a clear target, so where exactly they wanted the ball to go. And then also trying to remember what a smooth, successful putt felt like. So a kinesthetic target and a visual target. And so for musicians, it's not a visual target. It's not where do I put my fingers so much as it's what kind of sound do I want coming out of the piano when I start playing. And it's actually a great video on Carnegie Hall's website of Leon Fleischer giving a masterclass and saying this, you know, that his teacher used to tell him all the time, Schnabel used to say apparently to him that he needs to hear what he wants before he tries to play it. Otherwise, you know, I think as Schnabel said, whatever comes out, if you don't hear it first, is pretty much just an accident, right? And you're lucky if you got what you wanted, but because you didn't really tell yourself what you wanted, it's kind of leaving it up to chance. And so if nothing else, you know, before a student plays, it's helpful, I think even in lessons, to get them in the habit of, before you play anything, you know, hear it in your head, hear exactly what you want, and then try to remember how it feels when that's exactly what you get with your muscles, your hands, your arms, shoulders, back, everything, and then go for it. And then trust that it's going to work out. And it may not 100% of the time, but it's probably going to work out far more often than if you just kind of dove right in. Because I know it's a tendency, right? Like, tell somebody to do something, and before you've even done talking, it's like they want to jump in and do it.
But I was just going to say that. Like, yeah.
Just get in your head first, hear exactly what this is going to sound like, try to get an idea of what it's going to feel like, and then go for it. Because that's, I mean, the starts are so awkward and uncomfortable and scary. If they can get better at practicing what they do right before start, and then the start, just as it's going to be on stage, makes starting on stage a lot easier as well.
Mm. And yeah, I like to encourage my students to just give it a bit of space before they begin to. Otherwise, as you say, they can dive in before you've even stopped asking the question or whatever you've wanted them to do. Okay. So while they're, I think one of the hardest times too for any musician is, and this is perhaps less relevant for sport, although I guess when you're lining up at the starting line, it's kind of similar. When you're sitting in the, you know, in the wings or in the corridor before your exam or audition or whatever it is, that's when you're freaking out, right? What do you do? What do we encourage our students to do during that time apart from, you know, stress?
Well, sometimes it's helpful to know what they're thinking about to begin with, because some of them might have helpful things to think about. Others of them might just be freaking out and worried and things like that. So it is a difficult time. And one of the more helpful things, I think, to think about is to try to engage in some visualization, right? Remembering what have things sounded like, what if things felt like when I've had great performances of this particular piece, or even great performances of other pieces in the past, and imagining how this one's going to go, and kind of getting into the nuances and details of that. So some people actually have headphones on, not even with music playing, but just, you know, to kind of help provide a little bit of blockage. I mean, in one extreme situation, I came across a player who had like those industrial strength, you know, the ones that like folks wear when they're at the airport trying to park airplanes, you know, they're like with the sticks and waving and like those huge, like, so someone actually, you know, whipped that out of their case.
Earmuffs.
Put those,
Yeah,
like big, huge noise, like industrial earmuffs. Yeah. So that I've seen that before. I've seen regular headphones. But, you know, having a way of just giving yourself a little bit of space to visualize what it is that you do want, what you're trying to go for. But also it's a helpful time to remember to breathe. I think we tend to start getting really rapid, shallow breaths, and also maybe sometimes even forgetting to breathe. And so if diaphragmatic breathing isn't part of the student's arsenal, and you know, most students probably haven't even heard of it, it's a helpful thing to help them develop and practice and try and utilize.
Can you tell us a bit between more about that?
Sure.
I'm thinking I know what diaphragmatic is that right? Breathing is? So yeah, more into your belly than up in high in the chest. Is that right?
That's right, yeah. And, you know, there's tons of information online on diaphragmatic breathing. It's something that's used in pain management to, you know, in classes that they have for parents who are going to have babies. You know, they have that sort of breathing. And singers and wind players, brass players, obviously, that's part of their technique. But yeah, I mean, essentially the easiest way to actually experience what diaphragmatic breathing feels like is to, you know, sit down in a chair and actually put your elbows on your knees, kind of like, you know how sometimes people sit when they're feeling sick to their stomach, they kind of lean over, you know,
like the brace,
elbows on knees. Yeah, something like that. And then, you know, when you breathe, you inhale through your nose, exhale through your mouth, you find that your tummy expands quite a bit in that particular position. Somehow when we're standing and when we're seated upright or even lying down, it's a little bit harder to feel. But that position somehow, I think it's called tripoding, that seems to make it easier to experience what that feels like. And we can kind of fill our lungs up to a greater capacity and slow down our breathing and simply paying attention to what the breathing feels like and sounds like too can help quiet our thoughts and just kind of level us out a little bit. It doesn't take us to comatose on a sleep, but it takes the edge off enough that we feel a little bit more like we can manage things.
And I think that's another good simple tip we can, you know, even with our students before their performance in our last lesson, just do some deep diaphragmatic breathing with them just to get a sense of what they need to remind themselves to do. I remember my teacher before I did my diploma in the lead up, she gave me some tips of physically with your hands. Just she had a bit of a routine of kind of rubbing up each knuckle like this and just kind of massaging the hand, just one finger at a time and then to the next finger and really kind of working in the palm here and just kind of awakening the musculature. And you can kind of do that while you're deep breathing and sitting in the chair or the side of stage or whatever you're doing. And I found that also instantly gave you a little bit more dexterity before you go on stage. So I think, you know, if we can give students just some little pointers, little reminders about things to do, I think that's just going to make such a difference for them.
Well, I was going to say part of it too is, you know, engage in this sensory activity, right? You're paying attention to how your hands feel or your fingers feel as you're doing that. And to the degree that we can really be present in the moment, you know, it's kind of quiet our thoughts and fears about the future with what's happening right now. You know, what am I experiencing? What am I feeling? That does a lot to kind of take the edge off as well.
And I know that having done a meditation course some time ago, there's a lot of talk in meditation about getting out of your head and getting into your body more. So to get out of all this, you know, the brain works at a million miles an hour, to slow it down by actually doing something more body-based. So if it's with the hands or it's the breathing and just kind of concentrating on that. I mean, it all sounds really wishy-washy, but, you know, it is so good. And I know from my own experience, as you do, and I'm sure a lot of other people listening, that just having a little routine and getting your breathing under control has a pretty big impact too. Now, with visualizing, you've mentioned that a couple of times. Just before you play, obviously, you know, hearing in your head what you want something to sound like is great. But what about in the lead up few weeks? Is kind of lying on your bed and listening to a performance with your headphones, with your eyes shut, and picturing yourself playing like, you know, Marta Argerich? Is that a good idea?
I think it's certainly helpful. The way most people do visualization isn't where they're passively listening to something. I do like that. If it's difficult to imagine yourself playing well, because that at least gives you kind of a template, an auditory template, or even a visual template. Well, you provide the visual template, but it gives you at least an auditory template of what's possible. And so I personally like that, and I think it can be helpful. Most people, though, with visualization, or most research studies, have to do with you bringing the entire package, right? You bring both the visuals and the auditory experience into the visualization. I think that's also really helpful, and perhaps even more so, because it forces you to create the performance you want in your head without relying on muscle memory. So it'll become clearer if there are tricky memory areas or sections where you're not quite sure what to do, because you'll go blank at those moments. It's easy to sit down at the piano and just kind of have things roll out the fingers or just kind of have things happen, but we have to sit quietly without the piano as a reference in front of you and actually recreate everything. It's like, where do my hands go and what's this going to feel like and what do I want to hear? That takes a lot more work because we have to manufacture it all. So I think it can certainly be a helpful thing to do. And even if it's not the entire piece, although, you know, if students are spending a lot of time driving in the car, I mean, what else are you going to do in the car? Well, I guess nowadays there's iPods and, you know, iPhones
and
all sorts of, right, all sorts of things to listen to. But back in the day, you know, there was just a tape player And I got tired of listening to tapes, and so a lot of times it'd just be silence, and I'd sit and kind of practice what I wanted to sound like in my head on these long drives. And even if it's just going through a movement or difficult spots or parts of things, I think it's a good thing to do while we're in transit.
And how important is picturing yourself playing, actually seeing yourself on stage, on the stage that you're going to perform at, or the exam room or whatever it is, seeing yourself doing it and doing it perfectly and brilliantly? Is that a good tip, a good thing?
I think it's helpful in that it makes the situation less new and less novel, and then potentially less distracting when you go in there. Because if you've seen the place before, if you can imagine yourself what it's going to feel like walking in, what it's going to be like to sit down and adjust the bench, and you know, then to start playing and hear yourself sounding exactly the way you want, and seeing people where they're going to be, that way when it happens, it's like all the things that we're going to experience aren't going to be, well, I think I said, yeah, it's just not going to be as distracting. We can devote our attention and resources to what we actually want to do and what's happening in the music, as opposed to things that are not so relevant. Although, I think it's important to not imagine things going perfectly, right? Because things never do. And then if we've imagined walking in and feeling calm like we do in the practice room, if we imagine going in and sounding better than we've ever sounded and calm, and you know, everything just goes perfectly according to plan, well, when that doesn't happen, you know, when someone coughs and sneezes and the cell phone goes off or baby cries or you know, our heart's pounding in our chest or hands are slippery and sweaty, and like when those things happen, it totally throws us off more, because it's like, oh no, I'm not ready for this. I wasn't prepared for this. It was supposed to go very differently. Yeah, right. So when we, you know, so it doesn't mean that we spend all our time visualizing bad things happening, but we want to envision, you know, the realistic things happening, but sounding great and being resilient in the face of adversity and being really happy with the whole performance as a whole anyway. So we envision that great outcome, but not expect that it's going to be a piece of cake or just a walk in the park.
And you mentioned distractions before. I wanted to ask you, is it a good idea for teachers to purposefully distract their students while they're performing as a practice for not being distracted on stage?
I think it's a very valuable thing, because, I mean, a lot of times it's hard to replicate the kinds of distractions that we'll experience on stage, and a lot of the distractions are internal as opposed to external. But regardless of the source of distractions and regardless of what the actual distractions are, the things that we need to do, the things that we need to think about to perform optimally remain the same. So it's a good way of giving us an opportunity to practice those things while there are other non-relevant, non-helpful things going on around us.
Okay. So yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, it should be. And is it good for students or performers to feel like they're in a bit of a bubble? Like actually picture themselves, you know, in a cave underground and it's just them and the piano? Or is actually that detracting from their ability to perform to an audience?
You know, this is not something that I think has been studied, and I'm not sure how it would be studied. I do recommend or teach a lot of students and musicians how to practice using some sort of an image like that, you know, to imagine that it's just you and your instrument, and you have this, you know, kind of
protective
personal space where, you know, you're free to do anything and everything that you want to, and all the stuff that you produce goes out effortlessly to whoever happens to be listening. But all the negativity and the noise and distractions, like none of that comes in to interfere with your, you know, your personal space. And whether it's an image of a cage or, you know, a ring of fire or whatever, it doesn't really matter so much. But it's that feeling of I can do anything I want to in this space and it's all fine that I think is helpful. As far as whether that detracts from our ability to communicate with an audience, for me, and I don't know if this is a personal thing or not, but I rather like the idea of trying to suck the audience in as opposed to trying to reach out and grab them. In the same way that, you know, you go to a store to buy something, and if there's a salesperson that's like trying to grab at you and kind of tries too hard to kind of get you, it's sort of a turnoff and you kind of back away. Whereas on the other hand, you've probably been to stores sometimes where there's a whole crowd gathering and someone's doing something really cool, whether it's like, you know, a piece of art or even just like a cool magic trick or something, and you know, they make the movement small almost, and they kind of bring everyone kind of wants to see, because it just sucks your attention in. And I've even heard a conductor talk about that once, where tendency sometimes, I think, when a conductor feels like the orchestra's tuning them out to make the movements bigger and to try to like reach out and grab and kind of get their attention. But he said that generally doesn't work. And what you actually can do instead is to do the opposite. Just kind of suddenly make all your movements really small and tiny and kind of intimate. And then suddenly people start looking up. It's like, what's going on? Where are we? What's happening here? And then their attention actually gets drawn in. And so for me, I think it's okay to think in terms of creating this like black hole of attention where it sucks everyone in, as opposed to trying to be so, I don't want to say extrovert, that's not exactly the right word, but trying to be so aggressive about gaining people's attention in a more overt kind of way. But, you know, I think different people respond to different things. So if you have a particularly extroverted student who's just, you know, completely open and out there, it might be that that actually works better for them in terms of feeling more in the moment and excited about things.
It reminds me of the classroom teaching technique of if the volume level's getting too loud and distraction's happening, don't just talk louder and start shouting. You start talking quietly and you try and draw everyone back in, sort of thing. It's very similar. Now, what's your take on sleeping and eating and rest when it comes to optimal performance? We have a lot of exams that go on in Australia, and I know a lot of students, because I do a lot of accompanying, you know, they'll have a full day of school and then they'll try and sit a grade 8 exam at 4 p.m. after a full day. And I've never been all that certain that that's a very good thing for them if they haven't had a bit of a break. And I know everyone's different, but a lot of performers will sleep before they perform, but they won't eat. They'll eat afterwards or whatever it is. Do you have any kind of just more general guidelines for teachers of students in their sort of between 8 and 15, you know, where most of my listeners would be teaching, about that pre-performance, those few hours or the day before or day of?
I think, and this is where preparation comes into play too, I think it's helpful to practice things. I mean, there's a saying amongst runners, I think, you know, nothing new on race day. Like, they're not going to try out a different pair of shoes or different pair of socks or, you know, different hydration protocol on the day of a race. I mean, they're going to do something that they've practiced and tested out and gotten used to. And so, I mean, to the degree that this can be practiced ahead of time, I mean, even say the first, you know, 2 or 3 weeks prior, you know, if they have the same schedule of classes and all that stuff, you know, just reserve 4 o'clock, even if it's just by yourself in a practice room, just reserve that time and do a dry run of, you know, am I going to try to take a nap beforehand, or am I going to, you know, have something light to eat, or am I going to go for a walk? You know, what am I going to do to optimize how I'm going to feel for this 4 o'clock, you know, exam or jury? And because for some people it's going to be different. For me, I never really liked eating beforehand. Other people, it's like they need to eat something beforehand. I didn't even really like drinking anything beforehand, at least for a couple hours. And for other people, it's like hydration, you know, depending on instrument too, can matter. So, I hesitate to make generalized recommendations other than it helps to test these things out in advance and kind of know what works for you. And even when it comes to eating, I think if you've done a good job of eating regularly and not taking in a lot of sugar or, you know, high glycemic foods in the days leading up to it, I think you'll just be in a better place anyway. It won't be just like, oh, okay, this one day I have to do everything differently. But it's kind of a gradual process of making sure you've kind of built yourself up to be where you need to be for that day. And I like the cycle of, you know, doing it a few weeks beforehand and just practice it so that, again, when you walk in there, it's going to be different, but you minimize the differences that you've not accounted for.
I like the idea, building on that, of asking students to, you know, if they know that they're going to be performing at 8 o'clock on whatever night it is, to, for the leading up, in the lead up week, to do it at 8 o'clock on as many days as they can, play through their full program as a mock performance in their studio and see how they're feeling, and, you know, put their iPad on as a video and record it, or get mum or dad to come and sit in and listen, and just get used to that time, performing that program at that time. As you say, I think that's obviously probably the better approach, rather than saying you should do X, Y, and Z, but just test it. Keep testing and see how that works. Now, this has been great, by the way. I've been making notes as you've been going. It's just been really, really helpful, and I hope listeners have been finding it equally as helpful. I've got another question for you, and that is coping with performance anxiety just about being more prepared and practicing more? Or is that just a part of it? Or is that everything? Is it about more practice, but more kind of focused practice?
You know, I think at the end of the day, it's a multifaceted approach. I think practicing more generally doesn't hurt, because the more prepared you feel, obviously, the more confident you can be about how you think you're going to do. And also practicing, if you're practicing not just going through repetitions, but if you're practicing to really understand the music better, you go in having more ideas about what exactly you want to say and what exactly you want to think about as you're playing. So that helps on that level too. But a lot of preparation that I talk about is, you know, the mental preparation. What kinds of drills and exercises and strategies are you preparing and practicing in advance so that when you get there, it's not such a different experience? And actually, as a great violin pedagogue, Galamian, taught at Juilliard for many years, and he used to conceptualize, or encouraged us to conceptualize, practice time as being divided into three components. Not on a day-to-day basis, maybe, but over the course of a period of time, where one third of it's conceptual, right? So we have to figure out what we want something to sound like, which can be some work in and of itself. And then there's the mechanical part, where we have to figure out how to actually produce what it is that we hear in our head. And then the last third, he said, we tend to neglect until too late, and that's the performance element. You know, how do we get from the very beginning to the very end exactly the way we want to and kind of see the big picture? And so that kind of practice is something that I end up finding myself talking a lot about. We've talked about some of those strategies already in terms of focus and in terms of what to think about before we start playing, and, you know, how to keep going and not be analyzing and listening for mistakes. And so that kind of preparation and practice is certainly a factor too. And then there's just the, you know, understanding, like you said, whether it's nutrition and sleep and what to think about offstage, and, you know, how to stay more focused while we're performing and to not let the distractions get to us, and how to build up confidence, you know, between performances, how to analyze a performance afterwards so we don't beat ourselves up, you know, too much and can still build off of whatever our performance ended up going like. So there's all that stuff. So, you know, I wish it was a simple, you know, formula. You just do X, Y, and Z and then you're there. But it's a combination of all those things, and it's ongoing, right? Because yeah, the better we get, the higher the expectations, and it's a never ending sort of thing. But what ends up happening, to speak to this notion of performance anxiety, is and there's a book coming out about this in the U.S. not about performance per se, but just in general with our lives and stress, in terms of whether we appraise things as a challenge or whether we see them as a threat, has a pretty significant impact, as it turns out, on our physiology and even our lifespan and in our emotional state. And so to the degree that we can prepare in all those different ways, not just practicing for skill development, it makes it easier for us to see an upcoming performance as kind of a challenge as opposed to a threat. And I know that it's just sometimes it seems like semantics, but you know, there are lots of times where we've been excited about things, and it feels very different than times where we've been approaching it with dread and anxiety and fear. So
it's a mindset thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, we're going to start wrapping it up, but I do have a couple more questions. One is on the big elephant in the performance room, and that's memory. And I've blogged a fair bit about my views on memorizing. And I'm not a huge memorizer. I'm much better sight reader than I am a memorizer, and I really struggle with it, and it puts me under enormous stress, more stress than usual, to perform from memory. How do you, what's the best word? How do you kind of link or work the two together? Students being expected to play from memory, and the anxiety that often causes, or do you perhaps find it doesn't cause so much anxiety? What are your thoughts on it?
Well, you know, fear of memory slips seems to be much more common to vocalists and pianists. And my wife's a pianist, and so, you know, we talk about how, you know, violinists have to deal with intonation, and that never ends. But pianists have way more notes, right? Like, you know, violinists, he just says, well, you just have one note to play, like, at a time. Whereas, you know, they have so many more. And so, you know, that's an interesting issue, and I remember enjoy reading some of Stephen Huff's thoughts on memory and, you know, how some pianists now are not playing from memory and whether it really matters or not, and the history behind the notion of memorizing. And for me, I guess from the psychological aspect, this is where the more prepared you are, the more you've done to put yourself in a position of knowing that you know the score, and the more unique strategies that you can employ, the more vivid strategies that you can employ. So for instance, as a kid, my mom used to sit me down and with a new piece of music that I'd started to learn, and take out a box of colored pencils, and like we'd go through and I'd tell a story about what I think was going on in this piece, and she'd draw all this stuff into the score. So all my Suzuki books were covered in, you know, colored pencil and drawings. But it made it really easy on multiple levels to not get lost. Because one, visually, it's so colorful. Like I can see everything. And then also, I'd have a sense of the structure of the piece, you know, where things repeated, where things didn't. Because sometimes things would repeat, but it, you know, kind of go off in a slightly different direction. And that means the story would go in a different direction slightly. And so there'd be all sorts of different anchor points as a way of kind of knowing where I was. And even, you know, I've learned about harpists. You know, harpists with their pedals, it's such a crazy thing. They can't see what's going on. They start playing wrong notes because their pedals are in the wrong places. And so they have these things called recovery points where they know that, you know, at certain points, you know, every so many measures, they know exactly what their pedals should feel and be set up like. So, you know, even with the drawing pictures in your score or some other method, having these recovery points, knowing that you can get started at any particular point, maybe not every single measure, but like you're never too far away from like another recovery point, a place where you know you can get back into things. And I mean, so there's any number of different strategies that we can use, but the more of them that we've employed, it's like, you know, it's kind of stuck in our head. It's harder for us to not be able to remember things. And then our confidence is greater because we know that we have multiple access points. It's not just, I hope it goes well this time and I hope I don't have any memory slips.
But I know, yeah, I know it inside out, and I've relied on more than just my muscles to memorize, right. Which, you know, that's the biggest challenge, I think, as teachers we have is our students only memorizing by muscles and just kind of turning the switch on in their brain and they play through it, which is great until someone slams the door and it all falls apart.
Right. And that's also where distractions, like you said earlier, can be really helpful. You know, messing with them, you know, starting to play a different piece or a different section of the same piece or it's any other, you know, metronome at the wrong tempo or something like that can be helpful to see if you can disrupt their ability to retrieve what they're trying to do.
And if my students are playing from memory, I like as a practice tool to get them to start from, yeah, as you say, multiple places from memory in the score. Mm-hmm. Without looking at the score as a practice thing. I think that's really, really important. And even doing all those points that they've programmed backwards, so starting right near the end and playing and then one back. I use the analogy of a freeway on-ramp or off-ramp so that they, you know, I say, you know, let's get another on-ramp. We need one somewhere here because that's a tricky
thing
or whatever. Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Now, you mentioned a book just before that was about to come out. Do you know the name of that book in case people are interested in finding it?
It's a good question. I do not actually.
Okay.
If you email me,
when you find out about it, we'll pop it on the show notes page.
It's actually very possible it doesn't have a title yet because it's in the process of being written.
Okay. Is this your book or are you involved?
No, it's not. You know, I spoke with someone who is one of the authors writing it. You know, these two people from California. I think one of them won the Nobel Prize, or maybe they both kind of as a team won the Nobel Prize for their work on kind of understanding how this challenge versus threat mentality can actually shorten lifespan. So yeah, I think performance stress is a very tiny piece of what they're talking about, but it sounds really interesting.
I know from exploring your website that you've got a course called Beyond Practicing. So can you tell us a bit about it? Is it kind of more for teachers or students and how it works?
Well, when I created it, it was in my mind designed for the, you know, the professional musician or the early professional musician. You know, someone, you know, taking lots of auditions or even, you know, in college, you know, getting ready to hit the professional world and really where the performance has started to feel a lot more high stakes in terms of their life and their career and their livelihood. So that's what it was designed for. And then, you know, it's been out for a few years now and I've been pleasantly surprised at how many teachers and educators have started using it, not just for themselves, but for their students, and how much they seem to enjoy being able to answer that question. You know, so what do I do when I get nervous on stage? And being able to prepare the students, it's added kind of a whole new dimension to what they offer as teachers and pedagogues, but also from themselves as performers. And that's why I think what I've loved most, to see these professional musicians who, you know, have, you know, serious orchestral careers or performing careers, and or just those who, you know, teach 40 hours a week but also continue to perform, be able to like test these things out for themselves, right? To kind of use them in the gigs that they do or the performance that they do, and be like, oh, you know, this is cool. And then share with their student, not from I read this somewhere, but, you know, I read this somewhere and I tried it out and this is how I made sense of it. This is how I made it work for me. Try it this way, try it that way. And knowing their student as well as they do, I think in a lot of ways, they're able to better impart these strategies than I might be able to, because I don't know their student. You know, the student has to figure it out for themselves. But no, with the teacher who's also figured it out, so I don't know. To me, it just seems like a cool way for students to get this information from a more personal source that they know and trust.
And I would encourage, you know, I was talking about in episode 15, motivation and how to get motivated as a teacher and the sort of things that you can do to keep your professional development alive. Mm. And one of those things is having some lessons and putting yourself through a performance. I think it is one of the greatest and most challenging skills for any teacher to go back and do that. And I learned so much from it. And as you've said, you know, you can take those skills that we've been talking about or that are in your course or both, try them out yourself, see what works, and then impart that to your students because you know them best. Is the course a printed material or is it a videos? How does it actually look?
It's a combination. I mean, it starts off with Don Green's mental skills assessment, and the course is based around targeting the specific strength and weak areas that your profile demonstrates or reveals to you. And it's a combination of written, video, and audio. The audio obviously is just from the video part taken out, but yeah, it's a combination of video and printed material, and there's worksheets and cheat sheets and exercise logs and things like that to make it a little bit easier to take action on these particular skills and activities.
Great. And we've, you know, we've talked about a few things today, but I imagine we've really just scratched the surface, and it's obviously been quite a general discussion. So from my understanding of your course, it will help teachers really find out their own strengths and weaknesses when it comes to their performance approach, and then be able to give themselves some more ideas about how they can improve those skills. So, you know, highly recommended. Where do they go to find out about that if they're interested?
Well, the website is bulletproofmusician.com, and right at the top of the screen, there's a menu, and online courses where they can go to learn a little bit more about what's involved in the course and what's in it and what it looks like. So
great. And obviously highly recommend you subscribe to Noah's blog articles. They're a classic. In fact, I found some just before that I thought were like just the name ones. You pick very good headlines. I'm very impressed. Here's a couple that I really loved. Your brain isn't wired for consistency, but that's not as depressing as it sounds, is one of your posts. Here's another one. A simple technique to prevent choking under pressure, which sounds like it couldn't possibly work. And while practicing while distracted is actually very important, sometimes, in brackets. So, right. Look, I love, like, you just have these kind of quirky titles, but you write so well. And I think, importantly, it's all research-based. So you actually say, here's the concept, here's the research, here's how it applies to musicians. So thank you for all, on behalf of the piano teacher or the music teaching world, thank you for all that you do, because I know as another blogger how time consuming it is to put those kind of articles together, but they are gold. Thank you.
I appreciate it. It's been a privilege and a pleasure to be able to reach people in this sort of way. You know, it didn't exist 10 years ago, so it's still kind of a cool thing to me.
I hope you enjoyed the chat with Noah. He's always great to hang out with and a fantastic person to follow. If you haven't followed his blog, then make sure you do go and check it out at The Bulletproof Musician. And next week on the podcast, we've got one of my great Aussie colleagues, the wonderful Anita Collins. on how to successfully navigate helping parents, particularly when their students are about to quit. Now, that's not the only thing we talk about. There is a whole lot more in this episode. It's a great one about brain science, adolescence, growing up, and how we can get the best out of our students in our studios. I really hope you'll join us next week for that. Until then, I'm Tim Topham, and you're listening to The Topcast from topmusic.co. We'll see you next week. For more information about this episode and to find out how to enhance your own teaching, visit topmusic.co. You'll find everything you need for your studio, from lesson plans to cheat sheets, quick win teaching ideas, and guides on how to build your teaching business. Plus, you'll be connected to a global community of the world's top music teachers. And when you're ready, join hundreds of other teachers around the world by becoming a Top Music Pro member and get access to all our bonus content and flagship courses. And don't forget to follow topmusic.co on social media and subscribe to this podcast wherever you listen to it. That's all for today. We'll see you in the studio.